This is the current federal tax developments for the week of September the 4th, 2018. Current federal tax developments are brought to you, as always, by Kaplan Professional Education and by your state society of CPAs. This week, we're going to be looking at a few things happening, and some of those will be an IRS warning to tax professionals regarding the FTC safeguard rules for confidential data. We'll have a clarification of how exemption amounts are going to apply to items that are tied to the exemption amount in 2018, since the exemption amount is otherwise going to zero. We'll talk about a lessee who was blocked from being able to claim a conservation easement deduction. And finally, we'll talk about a couple of issues, a letter ruling that allowed a plan to make contributions to employees who are paying student loans, and as well as a ruling that allowed extra time for a taxpayer to roll over a distribution from retirement plan when she had previously been relying on her former spouse, well, I guess current spouse, but spouse who moved out, and so wasn't available for the rollover, and it turns out she ended up putting it in the wrong account. So we have a couple of issues going on in that realm. Well, this week we're going to start, though, with an IRS little information they gave us. They gave us a news release, and this news release discussed issues relating to, essentially, the IRS's security summit, some issues for professional tax preparers about data security. One of the big things they told us this week about this was that we have some FTC requirements that CPAs should be paying attention to. These requirements deal with whether you have to, you know, what you need to do in terms of, as a CPA, protect your client's data. And we're going to talk about this with regard to the issue of, you know, what's regarded from the FTC standpoint as adequate data protection. Turns out a lot of CPAs, the IRS is concerned, aren't aware of what those protection items are. At least the IRS's electronic, ETAAC, the Electronic Tax Administration Advisory Committee, is concerned that a lot of CPAs aren't aware of what these requirements are. And because of that, a lot of CPAs probably aren't complying with this. One of the key issues that we take away from this is that the FTC requires a written plan. This is under the FTC safeguard rules. This is in news release IR 2018-175. Now, the FTC requires each company to, in a written document, designate one or more employees to coordinate its information security program. This should be entities that are in the financial sector. Identify and assess the risk to consumer information in each relevant area of the company's operation. Evaluate the effectiveness of the current safeguards for controlling those risks. To design and implement a safeguards program and regularly monitor and test it. To select service providers that maintain adequate safeguards. Make sure the contract requires the domain to attain the safeguards and oversee their handling of consumer information. And finally, to evaluate and adjust the program in light of relevant circumstances, including changes in the firm, business, or operations, or the result of security testing and monitoring. These are supposed to be flexible to allow it to go for different sized businesses, but key note that there are some parts that aren't very flexible. That is, for instance, you do need to have a specific person designated to take care of this program. The IRS warns that if you're not in compliance with these FTC rules, the IRS may treat this as a violation of the e-file standards. And again, that's a potential problem since the IRS in a news release specifically states that failing to do this would violate the e-file standards. Those e-file standards would be found in Revenue Procedure 2007-40, which are requirements you're to have to protect client data. If you're not properly doing that protection of client data, then the IRS considers it to be somewhat of a problem, shall we say. And they suggest that that could end up, at least theoretically, in you being kicked out of the program. Now, the IRS also reminds professionals that there are things that you should consult, including Publication 3112, the IRS e-file application participation notices. And that they remind you there that that tells you about having to safeguard the data. They remind you, Internal Revenue Section 7216 poses criminal penalties on any person engaged in the business of preparing or providing service to connection preparation of tax returns who knowingly or recklessly makes unauthorized disclosures. Note that recklessly. So if somebody gets in your system and you're deemed to have recklessly allowed that to happen, in theory, you're facing a 7216 violation. Also 6713, which is the monetary penalties on the civil side for that violation, as well as Revenue Proc 2007-40, we've already mentioned, which are the rules for electronic filing. This is just a reminder to you of all the requirements that you face in protecting data. And if that's not enough, they also remind you that most states now, and I think now every state has a data breach law that requires it. We got the final states in that finally they said, yep, we have a data breach law. You have to comply with it. Be aware of that. They give a link here, and we put it in the materials for a page maintained by the Federation of Tax Administrators that gives you information about each state's identity theft laws and how you have to deal with those if you have a breach. Well, let's get back to more traditional tax information now. Let's go ahead and let's talk about what the IRS released this week in Notice 2018-70, issued on August the 28th. This is a notice that deals with a problem. For 2018, the exemption for dependents is set to zero. Well, that's great, but you know there are other portions of the code that cross-reference it. Now, Congress did mention some sections, but not all, that needed to be fixed in the cross-referencing. What the IRS clarifies in this notice is that though for purposes of those other provisions, Congress did mention, we are going to treat the exemption amount as if it was what it would have been had the law not been changed. And specifically in Notice 2018-70, they're talking about things like setting it for, you know, purposes of, you know, the when we talk about the basically qualifying relative rule, who could be a qualifying relative. We talk about the new $500 credit that we're going to get for qualifying relatives. And we also talk about qualifying as head of household. It's one of the ways you can qualify is to have a dependent who's a qualifying relative. That amount this year will be $4,150. It's what the exemption would have been had the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act not passed. That will be adjusted for inflation each year. So basically, we're going to be using that as our number as if that was the exemption amount for this year. So when you have a limit that depends on having earnings, let's say no more than the exemption amount, $4,150 is the number for 2018, and it will be inflation adjusted in the future. Let's go to a tax court case now. This particular case is the case of Harbor Lofts Associates versus Commissioner. This is a published tax court case, 151 TC number 3. This case opinion was issued on August the 27th, and this opinion deals with a lessee who had an extremely long-term lease. The lease term went on initially, as I recall, began in 1979. The lease initially was going to go on for 61 years. Eventually, the lease was extended to run all the way through 2056. So this is quite a long-term lease. The entity in question was leasing property from an economic development corporation. So they leased it from the Economic Development Corporation, which was that involved in that. That was a not-for-profit organization that had ownership of the location. And Harbor Lofts took on a whole lot of the rights and obligations associated with ownership. So it had to pay all insurance and utility costs. It could use the buildings for multifamily residential uses and uses incidental thereof. They had the right of first refusal if Economic Development Corp was going to get rid of the property. They were going to be repaid a portion of their lease if there was eminent domain proceedings. They were required to keep and maintain the buildings at their own expense. They construct, although certain constructions had to be pre-approved by the Economic Development Corporation. They couldn't just do it that way. In 2009, they entered into a preservation restriction agreement with the Essex National Heritage Commission. Okay, that is a qualified organization under 170B3. And they had the proper language in there to say that the facade would be preserved, you know, perpetually, and that this facade otherwise would qualify. But the problem the IRS had in this case was Harbor Lofts didn't own the building. Now, Harbor Lofts tried to claim a rather large deduction for the easement they gave up. And there's no question they gave something up, right? Because otherwise they had the right to modify that area. They had the right to make changes. Granting the facade easement meant that they really had some severe restrictions on what they could do in the future through 2056 when this lease finally finishes. So, you know, that's going to bug them here for almost 40 years. So the question was, can they claim that deduction? Well, the IRS said you don't own the building. And so therefore you can't claim it. Harbor Lofts said, well, you know, basically, we and the not-for-profit own the building. We and the not-for-profit got together and made this donation. So really, we should be able to claim the deduction. Unfortunately for Harbor Lofts, the tax court agreed with the IRS. One of the key requirements to make a conservation easement donation is that you have to assure that the benefits are retained in perpetuity. Because Harbor Lofts did not own the building, they only had a lease right through 2056, they, acting by themselves, could not ensure that this would be maintained in perpetuity. They could only ensure that nothing would be changed through 2056. And even then, it was somewhat limited because, obviously, if there was an eminent domain taking, they'd get some money back. That probably could have been solved. But the thing that could not be solved is the fact that in 2057, Harbor Lofts could no longer control the property. They were not the fee owner of the property. The tax court made it very clear. You have to be the fee owner of the property. A lessee cannot claim the credit for a conservation easement donation. Now, this is a published case because that hadn't really been decided before. Nobody had ever raised the question. Well, now, of course, the question has been raised. We have an answer. May not like the answer, but we have it. So unless Harbor Lofts decides to appeal this, you know, or unless you want to see if maybe it worked better in your part of the country, we're basically now stuck with the fact that a lessee cannot make a contribution. Now, remember, as a published decision, even if you're not up in, and this was up in Boston, even if, let's say, you're located in California, if you make this donation, the tax court, at least, is going to toss it. So in that point, if you want to try to go this route, this would be the case where you make the donation, you go ahead and you pay the assessment when the IRS comes in, then you file your suit in district court. Or you decide that we'll go lose in tax court and because we're going to go battle this out in the Ninth Circuit. You know, if that's what you want to do, fine, but that's going to be a much more expensive tack to take. And certainly anybody thinking of doing it has to understand that A, it's very likely you'll be challenged because the IRS does like to look at these easements. And B, once challenged, you know, you need to either spend the money to get to district court when he's paying the tax and then fighting the issue, or you need to be willing to go to a court of appeals because the IRS is going to win this thing at tax court. So going through tax court is going to be going through the motions because the tax court is probably going to rule against you, you know, following if your facts are like this. So that could be a problem. Next, I want to talk about, this actually happened a little bit earlier, but it's gotten a lot of press in the past week, so I want to discuss it. This is private letter ruling 2018-33012. This was actually issued on August the 17th, but it's gotten press this week because a lot of people have picked up and run with this ruling. Now, this ruling involves an employer. The employer had a 401k plan they maintained for their employees. The employer is now wanting to make a change to the plan. What the employer wants to do is amend the plan, in this case, to offer a student loan benefit. And what would happen in this case is if an employee elects to enroll in this program, if they make certain payments to against their student loan, at least in an amount equal to a certain percentage of their compensation, it could either be on an annual basis or it could be on a payroll, on a pay period basis, the company will make a non-elective contribution to the 401k plan. They have a set amount, which in this case was going to be 5% of their compensation for the relevant period. So we get a 5% contribution if we pay down our student loan. And as I recall, the student loan pay down amount would be 2% of your compensation. So employees that sign up for that, they'd get this extra contribution that would go into their account. Now, the question became is this okay? And our key concern is whether we're going to run afoul of Internal Revenue Code Section 401k 4 Cap A or Regulation 1.401k-1E6. And the key issue here is these are the contingent benefit rules. And the code actually says that you can't have a qualifying 401k arrangement if a benefit is conditioned directly or indirectly on the employee electing to have the employer make or not make contributions under the arrangement in lieu of receiving cash, deferrals. The question is, if you add this in the program, is that going to run afoul of these problems? And the regulations say basically the same thing, not surprisingly, since the law says that. The IRS in this ruling said in this case, this is not a contingent benefit and that we bless your plan. You know, in essence, you're going to be able to do this inside your plan. However, there's an interesting caveat. The employer had to state that they would not themselves make loans to employees, and basically the IRS conditioned their approval of this 401k on the employer never actually making such loans to employees. That's interesting. The IRS is seeing this maybe a way to try to work around some of the rules. Now, there's a lot of discussion whether other employers can do this. One big warning, this is obviously just a private letter ruling. Now, it means that most likely the service is okay with this, but the only party that can rely on that is the one that got the private letter ruling. Therefore, a lot of discussion is being given currently to should the IRS actually issue a broader set of ruling that has broader coverage that accomplishes the same thing. That is, should they say that these type of education loans are acceptable? If your client is interested or your company's interested in doing this, I would probably wait to see if that wider guidance comes out or even consider, yeah, it costs some money, but maybe going for your own private letter ruling. My guess is if the IRS gets a bunch of private letter ruling requests all asking for, you know, approval for a program like this, that will speed up how quickly they would issue a general ruling in the area. But it is dangerous to go it alone. Obviously, option three is go it alone. Just do it. You know, put that in your plan. Don't go for a formal private letter ruling and hope everything goes through. That's probably a riskier version. So we'll have to kind of see how that goes. But it is interesting that we're actually this far through the system and this far through how that would work. Next up, let's talk to you about one that initially surprised me a little, but then I thought about it. No, it's not really that surprising. This is private letter ruling 2018-35017. This one was issued on August the 31st of 2018. This particular case involves an employee who is receiving a distribution from a retirement program. We know it's a retirement program because they're asking under Section 402 rather than asking under Section 408. IRAs would have come under 408. Retirement programs come under 402. This woman received a distribution from the retirement program. Now, she tells the IRS that she had relied on her spouse throughout their marriage to take care of all tax and financial matters. The ruling implies, but doesn't actually totally state, that after the distribution came out, but after she qualified for the distribution, but before it was actually finished, her husband and her separated. And not surprisingly, you know, your soon-to-be ex-spouse isn't probably going to want to go manage your finances for you, or you may not really feel like having your soon-to-be ex-manager finance for you. In any event, she fouled up. And she ended up putting the money into an account that was not an IRA account. And the 60-day period expired. Now she's asking the IRS for, you know, please, IRS, is this reasonable cause for which I can make a late contribution? Now, somebody's saying, wait, didn't the IRS put out a general purpose, you know, late rollover revenue procedure? Yes, they did. But it only covers those very special, you know, this particular areas they listed, which there's a whole bunch of them. But my spouse moved out and I relied on that person to take care of all my finances is not one of the things in the list. So this person had to approach and pay for, which is probably the big negative, a private letter ruling to be able to take her retirement funds and try to take them out of that non-IRA account and move them to an IRA account. Well, the IRS actually approved this, right? Even though she placed it in a non-IRA account, they said, you know what? We believe that is a reasonable basis. That in this case, we believe that this represents, you know, that's good cause. And for that reason, you didn't use it for anything else. You intended to roll it over. You just didn't understand the rules. In this case, ignorance is fine because I guess fine enough. Now, my first thought was, wait, you know, hasn't the IRS said more than once a taxpayer has responsibility to find out what the rules are to make some reasonable attempt? And it doesn't appear that she made any attempt. She just dumped it in the account and then later discovered that that was going to cost her a ton of money. Well, that might have been the way you looked at it, but then I thought a little differently. We've multiple times had situations where, let's say, a spouse has relied on another spouse. That spouse dies or becomes, you know, otherwise incapacitated. And the IRS has said in that case, oh, yes, we understand totally. You know, we're going to let you roll over late. In one sense, this isn't necessarily all that different. You know, she was not sophisticated. She didn't handle this. You know, obviously she's claiming, I just didn't know. The IRS did not say in this case, well, you know what? That guy moved out. So you really should have taken it on your own to go find additional guidance and, you know, try to get this fixed. No, they granted it. My thought is, yeah, it makes sense. Now be careful. I suspect that you need to be in a position where your case otherwise looks to be, shall we say, sympathetic to the IRS to get this sort of result. I'd be a little concerned about some cases. The IRS may not like this, may not give you this result. But it does suggest and remind us one other thing. Even if a client doesn't meet the automatic requirements, you still can ask for the private letter ruling and you still may get it. Depends upon the nature of your issue and whether the IRS is kind of going to be sympathetic to your situation. Remember, if you go for this, what I've always told you for, that when I've been involved in doing this, I've usually called the IRS's, called the person who's signing these, you know, to find out what people have been signing these recently. And you can find out, read this private letter ruling, you'll find out who signed this one. Get their phone number in DC. It's a public item. Call and you know, explain your situation and see if they think the ruling would be issued. You know, if they give you the go-ahead, generally you're not totally good as gold, but you're pretty close to it unless there's some major fact you left out that they find out later. You know, and they say, wait, given that fact, it doesn't work. So bottom line, it always helps to take a look at this. Now, you know, in this case, obviously, if she managed to blow a $5,000 rollover, hate to tell you this, but the private letter ruling fee is going to more than wipe out not only the tax, but the entire rollover. So no point in going for that. But if this were, let's say, $150,000 rollover, now suddenly that private letter ruling fee probably is worth it to get this done. If it's $500,000, definitely worth it to try to get this ruling put together. Well, this week, we're not going to be quite as long as normal. Good news, you have a little bit less time because our week's a little bit shorter. Hey, this is supposed to be the end of summer. Now, here in Phoenix, we all know that, nah, it's not. But nevertheless, it still is. We are entering that time period you're all going to love when you're always within 2 weeks of a deadline. That's also great fun. But that also means that coming up the middle of next month, we get past the October 15th deadline, and CPAs tend to suddenly say, oh, I better get my education together. This now's the time. Here we are. We're at the beginning of September. You're not going to have more time to look at it before October 15th gets here. And you don't want to miss, for a lot of states, early sign-up discounts. You know, if you discover that, hey, the course I need is going to be offered on October the 20th, on October 15th, you're probably not getting any discounts. So, you know, take a look at your state CPA society and take a look what courses will be offered and, you know, plan it out. Make sure you've signed that up. We're going to be teaching a bunch. I'll be all over the place. I've got two courses, two times I'm going to be doing both in Boise and Phoenix sessions on basically the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act business issues updated for current guidance. We're going to be talking about the Cap A issues, 199 Cap A deduction issues. That's a major discussion point. And hopefully by the time we get to those, I'm going to be doing them in late October in Boise. I'll be doing them just before Thanksgiving in Phoenix. Hopefully by then we'll have our updated stuff. Also in Arizona, I'm going to be doing the current federal tax developments courses. I'll be doing those in Tucson in November. I've got a session in Tucson in November. I've got a session in Phoenix in December. Those also will pay a lot of attention to the new bill. But your state societies have other courses coming up that have those new bill issues. There's been a lot going on. And that's not even mentioning like the Wayfair case or the problem we've got with the partnership audit rules take effect this year. You got lots of stuff you need to get up to speed on because this coming tax season is going to be very different. Check and find your live CPE with your state societies. And again, check your catalogs and sign up. And sure, I'd appreciate if you sign up for one that I'm giving. But sign up for something. You really need the guidance at this point, and you want to make sure you get the most current guidance, that you're not taking some recorded program that was recorded back in March and frankly is wildly out of date. You need the latest, and the best way to get the latest is to show up for a live session and, you know, have somebody in the room who's keeping up to date tell you where we stand at the point you're talking about that day, plus interact with your other, met with other CPAs in your area. Lots of stuff we need to talk about among each other this year, so that all makes it important. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for this week, for September 4th, the Labor Day edition. You can catch our regular updates at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You know, we put them there. I post at least 3 or 4 articles a week there. You can send any questions or comments this week about this week's session, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also follow me on Twitter. I post at edzollers. I also participate in discussion groups for Arizona, New Jersey, California, those 3 state societies. So you can find me answering some questions or reading along there. I also read along on the Reddit group, our tax pros. I should also remind you, the California group Tax Talk, as I mentioned before, that's open to any CPA anywhere in the country. You've just got to go to Yahoo Groups, find Tax Talk, ask for permission to get in. And that is one huge resource, because as you might guess to start off with, there are a lot of CPAs in California. And secondly, there's a lot of CPAs around the country that are in that group. So it's a useful place to go look. Well, more things will be happening. And yes, even while you're trying to finish up all those 2017 returns, the IRS is probably going to be dropping more 18 guidance on us. So keep your eyes open. And we'll try to keep you up with all that stuff every week here on Current Federal Tax Developments. And we look forward to seeing you next week. We go through with more current federal tax developments.